Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, it's another big day in the race for the White House. Our correspondent joins us to talk about it all. And we'll have a look at how social media is being used in the Wisconsin primary.
Because social media goes out around the country and around the world, it's a really big megaphone for them.
Governments begin investigating public figures and the wealthy caught up in the Panama Papers scandal. And we'll share the excitement about what some say is the best college basketball game ever. It's right here on the Voice of America. Today's primary in Wisconsin could be a pivotal moment in the battle for the White House for both the Republican and Democratic parties. Correspondent Catherine Gibson is with me at the anchor desk to discuss it all. Hi there, Catherine.
Hello. How are you? Another primary, another day.
Yes, you're talking a lot about this stuff.
That's right.
Well, let's start with the Republicans. Why is today so important in their contest to select their presidential candidate?
Today is actually a huge day because we've gotten to the point in the contest where the window is closing for Donald Trump to win enough delegates to secure the Republican nomination on the first ballot at the convention in Cleveland this summer. If he does not do that, the field is wide open. Mm-hmm. Then we'll have to go to multiple rounds of voting at the convention, and anything could happen. So if he wins tonight in Wisconsin, he really secures that lead going into the next round of primary contests, but it doesn't look like he's going to. Ted Cruz is by all accounts, heading all of those polls. He's going to be the winner tonight. And then we'll have to see how he does in New York, which is the next contest.
And one of the issues here is that there are a lot of Republicans who are not happy with Trump.
Oh, that's
very true. They're actively pursuing him not to get the nomination, even though he's one of theirs.
That's right. The Never Trump movement really seems to have gained some steam in Wisconsin leading up to this voting. We're hearing radio talk show hosts encouraging Wisconsin voters to go out and not vote for Donald Trump to make sure that he's not the Republican presidential nominee. And, you know, Trump really hasn't helped that with the past week that he's been having, making very controversial comments about abortion. And we've seen his campaign manager accused of assault. This hasn't been a good week for him, and he really is not finding a way to recover from it.
And if Trump doesn't win tonight, that leaves something open for Kasich.
Oh, it certainly does. Kasich wants to be the last man standing. He sees Donald Trump making all of these blunders. He sees Ted Cruz, who's not really well-liked by the Washington, D.C. establishment, and he thinks, hey, if these two guys are standing by me, nobody is going to want to see them as the nominees. I could be the best last hope.
He does have a shot at it if Trump doesn't win tonight.
True.
Well, over in the Democratic camp, what's going on between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders?
That's right. Well, today looks to be a pretty good day for Bernie Sanders. Everything in Wisconsin plays to his strengths. This is an open primary, which means that people can register on the day of and go to vote. That brings out all of the young voters that Bernie Sanders really speaks to here in this country. And he's pulling well ahead of Hillary Clinton.
It's surprising Hillary doesn't have more young voters.
You know, that's been the big question of her campaign, Susan. Everyone is wondering why she can't mobilize that excitement among young people. And it may be that she's been in the public eye for so long, people are so used to her, that it's hard to really build up any kind of momentum.
Do you think anybody may drop out after tonight's balloting?
I don't think so. I think Bernie Sanders has the money and the momentum. He will stay in it until the convention. Hillary, of course, has the delegates. And over on the Republican side, they are fighting tooth and nail to get to Cleveland in July.
Okay, well, it should be an exciting night.
Oh, it definitely will be. That's for sure.
Okay, well, thank you, Catherine, for stopping by. For a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
What's going on the web today with this political situation?
Well, hashtag primary day. I'd love to actually, when the election is all said and done, look at when these spikes happened. And I think they match up very well with as the primaries are happening. No surprise there. But hashtag primary day is happening today in Wisconsin. So you see voters posting pictures in line. You see a lot of the campaigns posting little videos, endorsements. So you're seeing a lot of the things that campaigns would do in the real world, but on social media. So you see these, you know, commercials that would air on TV, but they're 30-second Twitter videos.
And they don't cost them anything.
They, you know, they pay money to promote them, I'm sure. They pay advertising money just like they would for TV, but they're putting them out there. And if they chose not to pay for it, I'm sure they would still get a lot of traction because of their big names. But the other interesting thing I saw was the information they would hang on doorknobs, you know, saying here's where your polling place is, here's how you go vote, here's how you register, because Wisconsin's an open primary. Anyone can show up and vote in either party. All that information is being shared in graphics on Twitter. People are posting them and saying, here's how you do this. The campaigns are posting them saying, here's how you go, here's where you need to go, here's what ID you need to have. So it's really taken the politics of kind of door knocking and get out the vote into the social media world. And it has a much greater, broader spread. I mean, case in point, I was looking at these things. I'm not in Wisconsin. If I was in Wisconsin, I would only get this information, you know, if it was hung on my doorknob or put on a flyer or something. Right. But now everybody, you know, throughout the country and throughout the world can see this.
And are the people of Wisconsin, are they Twittering to each other about who to vote for?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's one of the not-so-secret weapons for the campaign is trying to drum up this social media support. You know, certainly Bernie Sanders has done a very good job with that, Hillary Clinton as well, and Donald Trump has a very fervent base of supporters. But they're all using social media to try to convince their neighbors to get out and vote for their candidate and just publicizing who they're supporting and trying to get the word out. Again, because social media goes out around the country and around the world, it's a really big megaphone for them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
A newly published study suggests that due to human activity, Earth is entering an age of plastic, as our planet's waters and land will be buried in layers of plastic waste by mid-century. The study's lead author, Jan Zalaschwitz, says that discarded plastic can be found everywhere, from the tops of mountains to deep beneath the oceans. Despite its increased use, plastics don't degrade as easily as natural materials like paper and wood. According to the World Watch Institute, nearly 300 million tons of plastic are made every year. It was reported that in the U.S. alone, only 7% of all plastics generated in 2009 was recycled, with the remainder deposited in landfills and elsewhere. The study suggests that plastic will have a long-lasting impact on Earth's geology as it becomes a part of the soil and eventually a unique part of its strata. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The fallout from the release of millions of documents from a Panamanian law firm leaked to a consortium of journalists has just begun, with governments investigating how public figures and the wealthy may have used banks and companies to manage their secretive offshore accounts. Will Fitzgibbon is a reporter for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that was part of the leak of the so-called Panama Papers involving the Mossack Fonseca law firm. He says the revelation appears to have uncovered some illegal activity.
We have the largest ever leak of information to journalists that shows how the wealthy and the politically connected are able to operate for legitimate and sometimes illegitimate reasons, more or less anonymously and away from the gaze of authorities who might be interested in knowing if they're missing any taxes or if any activities that are breaking national laws are occurring in their own borders, but without their knowledge.
An anonymous source provided 11.5 million documents involving over 200,000 companies and over 14,000 clients to a German newspaper, which in turn engaged the investigative journalist group to work on the project. The law firm has denied breaking any laws. Rolanda Ocho, a lecturer at the Australian National University who follows organized crime and corruption, told VOA's Victor Beatty he is not surprised at this development, given the debate in recent years over the need for reform in the way such international financial activities are carried out.
Deep down, a lot of experts and people involved in this kind of work have known for a while that this system of moving money around has been going on for a while. I think this is just more than surprise. It confirms a lot of the things that we already knew were probably happening.
This doesn't necessarily mean this activity is illegal, but it can be.
Of course, some of this activity can and probably will be proven to be completely legal under international regulations. What I think it does point out towards is perhaps the need for further transparency in the way these systems are run, because there's certainly evidence, as I said, we know very little yet what's in those documents, but there seems to be evidence that there's some potentially dirty money having been funneled through this corporation, Mossack Fonseca, and through a number of countries, shell companies, etc., etc. So there is the possibility that illegal activity will be detected there. And I think what this points out towards is how we make this system more transparent and as well more accountable for what happens within it.
Do you think that such transparency will be all of a sudden at the top of the agenda of many world governments as a result of this?
That remains to be seen. I think it will depend which government you are referring to. I would suggest that maybe some governments will be more reluctant to really react to this information. Some perhaps might be more open to it. Obviously, the more democratic, accountable governments might have a bigger incentive to react to this information and make sure that, you know, their companies, at the very least, behave in ways that are legal. Having said that, I think there's many countries who are involved in this leak who may not have the best incentives to pursue this and put it in the top of the agenda.
Will this likely die down after a period of time?
I don't think so. I think there will be a lot of public outcry about this, particularly when we are talking, you know, for example, here in Australia and in other places, we're talking about big corporations and how they use the advantages of the international financial system to not pay taxes or pay less taxes. So this is something that's been sort of bubbling in people's minds and in the agenda of certain governments for a while now. So I don't really think that, given these huge revelations, the names that we have seen so far involved in this leak, as you said, includes politicians, artists, you know, football players, everyone who has a lot of money basically somehow has something to lose. So I don't think it's going to go away very easily, particularly if, you know, at the political level, activists and also, you know, potentially representatives, political parties take this on as a cause, which I think will happen.
Following the document leak, China today limited coverage of the issue, while the foreign ministry spokesman declined to comment on what he called groundless accusations. Two of the world's largest banks, Credit Suisse and HSBC, denied reports they actively used offshore accounts to help clients evade taxes. Meanwhile, France, Australia, New Zealand, Austria, Sweden, and the Netherlands announced they have launched separate investigations. The Russian government denounced the Panama Paper disclosures, saying they were mostly aimed at President Vladimir Putin, and claiming former U.S. State Department and Central Intelligence Agency officials helped analyze the documents. A report from the leak said Putin associates had funneled nearly $2 billion through offshore accounts. A spokeswoman for British Prime Minister David Cameron declined to comment on whether his family had money in offshore accounts set up by his late father, Ian Cameron. She called it a private matter. And the U.S. Justice Department said it is reviewing the journalist's report and takes very seriously all credible allegations of high-level foreign corruption that might have a link to the United States or the U.S. financial system. Coming up on International Edition, storks with an eating problem and details of the big game. Storks in southern Europe have become junk food junkies. Thousands have given up their winter migratory habits to feast on trash in landfills. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, they have become resident birds with nests nearby, but it is not just because of the food. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel has their story.
When dump trucks pull into landfills in Spain and Portugal, storks are not far behind. They've come for a banquet of rotten fish, rancid chicken, leftover hamburger, and pizza. The putrid smell doesn't bother the storks, who nest nearby and raise their young. These same birds used to winter in sub-Saharan Africa, but many don't anymore, says Aldina Franco, a conservation ecologist. Her team at the University of East Anglia in England equipped the birds with GPS devices to track their movement. She says migrating patterns began to change about 30 years ago.
In the 80s, we started seeing some individuals remaining in Europe the whole year, and then that number started increasing gradually and increased a lot and exponentially in recent decades, so that we now have only in Portugal more than 14,000 storks wintering in the country.
Not all storks have adopted the landfill as home. Some birds continue to drop in on a seasonal basis, although their numbers are falling. Franco says those that stay year-round are opportunistic, adapting to changes in the environment, including a warmer climate.
The climate becomes milder, so the winters are milder. Therefore, there will be more grasshoppers, more invertebrates available on natural habitats. Then, at the same time, this crayfish comes to Europe and invades, and it's an extra food resource for the storks. And at the same time as well, there is more landfill, more food that is wasted and thrown away, therefore also another extra resource.
Storks can live 25 years or longer, which gives researchers time to study the mechanism that is changing migrating habits. Franco is interested to see how those habits change again, as rubbish dump sites in Portugal in coming years are scheduled to be gradually replaced with compost factories.
Will the storks remain, the ones that are resident, will they remain in Iberia and eventually starve? Or will they completely switch strategy and go and feed on natural habitats because food is now more abundant due to global warming? Or will they become migrants? Possibly again, we don't know that.
Franco hopes to answer those questions in future studies. She writes about her work in the most recent issue of the journal Movement Ecology. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Green Bee for a healthier planet.
There's nothing unusual about a rooftop garden, but how about a 23,000 square meter rooftop greenhouse growing vegetables in the middle of a Chicago winter? Here's Jen Freymark, co-founder of Gotham Greens.
10 degrees outside today here in Chicago, and you know, it's 75 degrees in here right now.
The greenhouse is about the size of two American football fields, but it's not just the size that's unusual. It's what's growing in the greenhouse, which, by the way, sits on top of a soap factory and employs a wind turbine for part of its power. The power needed to grow warm weather lettuces. John Damus of Chicago's Lux Bar is one of Gotham Green's customers.
To be able to cut down lettuce and harvest it by hand and have it delivered and on the plate within hours is a huge deal.
And it's a huge fuel saver because most of the greens available in cities like Chicago are grown in California, several thousand kilometers away. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
March Madness has come to an extremely exciting end with what some are calling the best college basketball game ever. I've heard that all day long. Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports joins us here in the studio to tell us all about it. He's full of enthusiasm as usual. Hi there, Sonny.
Sporty greeting, Susan.
Thank you, Sonny. Well, you've got the floor. Tell
extremely
us, what made
exciting.
This so fantastic?
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it, Susan. Extremely exciting indeed. Many people are calling this, if not the greatest final, one of the greatest finals in the 78-year history of the men's championship tournament. Villanova edges North Carolina 77-74 on a buzzer-beating three-point shot by Chris Jenkins. He released the ball with less than a second left on the clock, so that...
I was holding my breath. I got to tell you, I watched it, you know, clips this morning, and it was, you just didn't know.
And I think they'll probably be showing that shot on highlight reels for years and years to come, Susan. It was so dramatic. And the Villanova players, of course, celebrated immediately.
Oh, it was chaos everywhere on
the court.
On campus as well.
But I think we should listen in to the exciting call of the final few seconds by Villanova broadcaster Ryan Fannin.
3 seconds to go across the timeline. 2 seconds to go. Jenkins three, right wing to win it. He made it! He made the three from the right wing at the buzzer. Cats win it all! Cats win it all! Cats win it all! 31 years later, Villanova is the king of college basketball once again.
Yes, Villanova, the king of college basketball, once again, 31 years after winning its first title, Susan. So they had a long wait between titles.
They sure did. But that's worth it. It was worth it.
It was worth it. And at the post-game news conference, Chris Jenkins described his winning shot.
I always take the ball out. So from previous games, I realized when I take the ball out and the ball gets up the court, the defenders usually follow the ball. So I knew when I gave Arch the ball, he was going to be aggressive. And, you know, they were going to try to take Arch away because he's hit big shots in his career. So when they all followed the ball, I just knew, you know, if I get in his line of vision, then he'll find me. And for him to be so unselfish and give up the ball, you know, it just shows what type of teammate he is, what type of person he is. We put a lot of work in, you know, this team, and, you know, everybody has the confidence to catch and shoot. So when Arch threw me the ball, one, two step and shoot him up, sleep in the streets.
Shoot him up and sleep in the streets. I guess they've been partying all night,
yeah.
So you got to sleep in the streets.
Yeah, and they don't have to go to school today. The school called off classes
That's
today.
That's right.
So they could stay in and get over their hangovers, I guess.
Now, Susan, from a local perspective, Chris Jenkins, who we just heard from, he played his high school basketball right here in Washington for Gonzaga. So Gonzaga representing at the NCAA championship tournament. But yeah, it was a great game, Susan.
Did you stay up and watch it?
I watched the highlights, but it was a little past my bedtime.
Oh, how late did you go? It was after midnight, wasn't it?
I made it to the halftime, but it ended about 11:15 Washington time.
I heard somebody, Andrew, was saying that they turned off the TV set just before that last point. Oh!
Very exciting stuff.
Okay, well, thank you, Sonny, for stopping by. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you, Susan.
We'd like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab and scroll down to International Edition. And by the way, you can visit Sunny Side of Sports there too. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The last few weeks have not been good for the advancement of ISIL's goals in Iraq and Syria. At a recent press conference, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter confirmed that key ISIL leaders were killed by U.S. forces in March, including so-called Minister of War Abu Omar al-Shishani and Abd al-Rahman Mustafa al-Kaduli, also known as Hami Imam. Al-Kaduli, Secretary Carter said, served as a finance minister who was also responsible for certain external affairs and plots. He was a well-known terrorist within ISIL's ranks dating back to its earliest iteration as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Mr. Carter said. The removal of this ISIL leader will hamper the organization's ability for them to conduct operations both inside and outside of Iraq and Syria. Defense Secretary Carter said that the anti-ISIL coalition, in partnership with local forces, is putting relentless pressure on the terrorist group, noting that the successful capture of the Syrian town of Shadadi from ISIL earlier this year severed the main artery between Syria and northern Iraq, making it much harder for ISIL's forces to travel between Raqqa and Mosul, a key step in the campaign to collapse ISIL's parent tumor in Iraq and Syria. Another setback for ISIL occurred when Syrian government forces, with the help of Russian air power, drove ISIL from the ancient town of Palmyra, one of the few times that Russian air power was used against ISIL instead of against anti-Assad rebel forces. Pentagon spokesperson Peter Cook welcomed the defeat for ISIL, but stressed that the Assad regime is the primary cause of the Syrian civil war and that its focus right now should be trying to end that civil war and by engaging in the diplomatic process that's currently underway in Geneva. Defense Secretary Carter said defeating ISIL militarily in Iraq and Syria, while necessary, is not sufficient. We must also destroy ISIL's metastases around the world. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke to that point when he stood with Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel after the terror attack in Brussels. All of us representing countless nationalities have a message for ISIL. We will not be intimidated. We will not be deterred. And we will come back with greater resolve, with greater strength, and we will not rest until we have eliminated your nihilistic beliefs and cowardice from the face of this earth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.